danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 253 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Catonsville, Maryland, I'm Andrew Brokus, bringing you a bit of bad news and a lot of good news. Bad news is Nate and I did actually record a proper introduction to the show, including a strategy segment. Between the two of us, we have three different recording mechanisms, programs that are recording the podcast, and we managed to not get a usable recording from any of the three of that introduction. So I'm just kind of throwing this together quickly. We're not going to have a strategy segment for this week, unfortunately. We do, the good news, is have a really fantastic guest, someone that probably will be recognizable to a lot of people, Brian Devonshire, Devo. And his career, I learned a few things that I didn't previously know about him from talking to him, but, you know, he's been playing since a few years before the kind of online poker boom, right? He was playing on, I don't remember what it's called now, the old school, not Planet Poker, Paradise Poker, before Party Poker even came onto the scene, before Chris Moneymaker won the World Series of Poker. So he's got some perspective on not quite the early days of poker, but earlier than the majority of our guests or even Nate or I can speak to. So some interesting perspective there from Devo. And also he lives quite an interesting life now. So he's kind of like a part-time professional poker player and a part-time river raft guide and part-time crypto kitty breeder and investor, which if you don't know what that is, don't worry, I didn't really either, and he explains it. So we talk about how he's cobbling these different things together, how he's living out of a trailer for a good part of the year, much like certain other guests we've had on the show from time to time, and the quite interesting life that he lives these days. So a really nice conversation with Brian. Hope you all will enjoy it. The one thing, you know, Brian, given his setup, he does not have his own internet connection in his trailer. So he's recording this from a bar. There is a little bit of background noise. I don't think it's too distracting, but, you know, you can tell that he's in a bar while he's recording. But this is what Brian's life is. When he needs internet, he goes to a bar, and that's how it works. Do want to make sure that I tell you about Tournament Poker Edge, that time of year when you probably want to be working on your tournament game, whether you're preparing for Spring Championship of Online Poker or World Series of Poker or any other poker tournament series you might be preparing for. I just want to improve your tournament poker game all around. Tournament Poker Edge can be an excellent resource for you. You can find hand history reviews from those series that I mentioned, from the World Series of Poker, from The Scoop, from lots of other tournament series, both live and online, and of course plenty of other tournament poker strategy material, some episodes driven by sort of slideshow theory presentations, some using tools like Card Runners EV, Hold'em Resources Calculator, Pio Solver, lots of ways to learn, lots of different people to learn from, all of it available to you for as little as $25 a month at tournamentpokeredge.com. On that subject, where are you now?
Right now I'm in the town of Lajitas, Texas. I'm a good drive and a 5-iron away from Mexico.
And it sounded like you're in a bar, maybe? I heard you're starting a tab.
Yeah, I'm in.
When you answer the phone.
I am. I'm in the Thirsty Goat Saloon at the Lajitas Golf Resort. They have a... It's literally right on the border. The Rio Grande flows by not too far over there. And right across the Rio is Mexico, of course. And, yeah, so we're going to go upstream and do an overnighter. And this is the convenient place to have good internet.
Well, thanks for making the time for us.
Totally. Thanks for having me. It's hard for all of us to nail down a time together.
I just mentioned that Brian and I have met one time before, and my memory of it is vivid. It was 2006, the summer of 2006, in a 30-60 Hold'em game at the Bellagio, and Roy Cook was in the game. And at one point, I put what was either just a lucky catch or possibly just a bad beat, and I should have folded the river on Roy. And Roy Cook being a gentleman, anything, but you turned to me and said, "Dude, he's going to write a column about you." and so that's my memory of meeting you.
That's fun. Did he ever write a column about you?
He did not. Nice guy, though.
You weren't even column worthy.
No.
All right, well, that's a story from 2006. How much further back than that does your poker career date, Brian?
I've got records going back to 2000. I started playing in casinos in 99 as soon as I turned 18. I was playing online in 99. I guess I didn't go full-time professional until summer of 03 and didn't really show up on the scene until 06.
Well, that's a little before kind of the typical like moneymaker era. What was your entree into poker?
Well, it really started with Magic the Gathering and the Star Wars collectible card game way back in the day. And my dad hosted a family game, small stakes, but, you know, fun and kind of serious. And so I've been playing in that since I was 13 years old. And yeah.
And that was, I guess, not No Limit at that time.
Oh, no. There was. I remember when I was in college, like, the big game I would play in every week was a 1-2 pot limit hold'em game that was only spread on Fridays at the Hustler.
So you were playing around LA?
I went to school at USC.
Okay.
And I remember when they first spread 1530 limit hold'em on Party Poker, and there's two games and a giant list, and we thought everybody was nuts.
Yeah, I was very intimidated, and I feel stupid about it now, looking back and knowing what I know about the big party games.
Right.
You know, that they were in fact not very difficult. But I was just like, people playing for hundreds of dollars must be so good. I'm going to stick with these $20 sit and goes.
Yeah, especially on the internet, man. You can't even see anybody. How are you supposed to deal with that?
What did you think when all the No Limit stuff started taking over? I mean, did you see that as an opportunity, or did you stick with limit stuff for a long time?
It was a challenge for me. I definitely punted off some stacks trying to transition from limit to no limit. But, you know, I can pretty distinctly remember, like, the day that limit died in Las Vegas, and I was just basically forced into doing something else. So.
Yeah. I've had that feeling a little bit about PLO sometimes, where it's like, that's the game everyone wants to play now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll do anything with an edge, so.
What's your split now between poker and is river guiding, is that the appropriate term?
Yeah, river guiding, I guess, would be the ubiquitous term. I've for the longest time, you know, just kind of done rivers in the summer and then amble in the off season. I'm always, like, you know, playing online here and there, and very active with cryptocurrency right now, so. I mean, basically, anytime I'm not on the river, I'm working on the computer, doing something or other.
And your setup, I mean, you're living out of an RV kind of full time?
Yeah, and I live in a pull behind camper. It's parked behind the outfit that I'm working for out of Terlingua. And it's pretty nice. April 1st rolls around and I don't have to think about rent or utilities or anything.
How long has that been your setup?
I've been full-time in a camper since June, and I can't believe it took me this long to get into it.
It seemed like you were pretty itinerant even before then, kind of going back and forth between, was it Mexico and the U.S. to play online? Was that the...
Yeah, I typically spend the whole month of November in Mexico, and then I'd be up in Colorado, like, December, January, February, March, kind of, and skiing, playing online. Real good tournaments roll through Colorado in the winter, and then Yeah, typically on the river by May.
How long have you been doing the river stuff? I mean, is that something you sort of grew up doing?
No, I got into rafting in 2002. That was when I went to guide school.
But, I mean, you must have had some interest in it. I mean, you don't just go to guide school out of the blue. Or did you?
Well, it was kind of out of the blue. Like, I grew up surfing, so I was always around water and loving, you know, dynamic waves and stuff like that. I was actually working for a church in Los Angeles, and we started an outdoor program and wanted to centralize it around rafting. So, yeah, that's how I ended up going way in the first place. But then I absolutely fell in love with it and have made it a part of my life since.
It seems like a pretty good, I mean, so many people, like, poker is such a kind of frustrating and also individualistic pursuit, you know, where it's kind of, your gains are at someone else's expense, so it's a zero-sum thing, and it seems like the rafting is a nice way of doing the opposite of that.
I definitely wrestled with that for a while when I was, you know, full-time poker, and just that was all I did. Like, kind of in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, like, how am I benefiting the world here? And it's pretty hard to make a strong argument, really, in any case. I mean, the best argument I think you can make is that you can enhance the experience of those that you're playing poker around.
Yeah.
And I've always been intentional about making poker fun for those I'm playing with, not wearing glasses and not wearing hoodies and keeping the game social kind of thing. But I still get on the rivers for very selfish reasons. Like, I don't need the money. I do need to be on the river. It's just essential to my soul. And my favorite thing on this earth is to watch other people discover what I love and to see people look up in these canyons and see things that they've never seen before and never thought of before and just watch their whole outlook on things change for the better. Like, sure, that's giving back, but I'm still doing it for selfish motivation. Like, I just love that so, so much. So, I don't know. I mean, I am giving back, but I'm certainly not doing stuff that I don't want to do, you know?
I mean, that seems like the ideal setup, if you can kind of be creating value for others without, you know, needing to really sacrifice your own interests or happiness or whatever. That sounds like a pretty good arrangement to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so. I can say that I'm just nailing it, but
you don't sound so convinced.
I don't know. I mean, I'm way less motivated to, like, go give blood.
How often would you say that occurs when you're guiding? I mean, that you can sort of witness someone having a religious or whatever experience, a mind-blowing experience one way or the other.
I mean, it's almost a daily thing.
Wow.
Like, I mean, we take the trips I'm doing down here, we're averaging, oh, like 15 people on the water for a day, and one of those people is just going to have their mind blown. It's just the nature of the river and the wilderness and these canyons and the trip. It's contagious. So, yeah, it's a super regular thing. And, yeah.
Does poker feel kind of anticlimactic after, like, when you kind of shift from guiding mode into poker mode? What's the experience there?
It's fun. Like, I've always enjoyed poker, and having this balance in my life allows me to be stoked about poker when I go and play poker.
So you're kind of like ready for it when that season rolls around.
Yeah, and I spend a lot of time just, like, you know, working on my game when I'm not at a poker table. Like, I think I'm pretty well ahead of the curve right now. Like, I spent the whole offseason mostly chasing the World Series circuit, trying to qualify for the national championship, and I was putting into play stuff that I had just kind of thought about all summer, and it's definitely stuff that, like, people aren't doing that, you know, colleagues are like, I don't like that play. I'm like, well, you just haven't thought about it. Try it out. It actually kind of works.
Is that the form that your preparation, like when you say preparing during the off season, is it literally just sitting around thinking about stuff, or are you, you know, making active use of PO Solver or some tool like that?
Yeah, and so it's thinking about stuff, and then when I get to a computer and internet, then applying it to, you know, I still use a lot of old school poker stove. I should get into more of the, learn some more of these solvers, but I'm definitely like actively balancing my range a lot more, you know, throwing in some of those game theory stuff, but I'm doing it in such a way that it's just like, you know, naturally balanced. Mm-hmm. That in such a way that it's happening, you know, with random triggers that I've, you know, kind of worked out, you know, in the off season. And so it's like, oh, I have this hand of that color, and that means it's time to go bananas. Let's do it.
How much at this point are you, I mean, you mentioned targeting the WSOP circuit. I mean, what's your split when you are playing between your tournaments and cash games, no limit versus other games, et cetera?
I'm pretty exclusively tournaments nowadays. Even online, I still think the MTTs are really just still a trick to get people to play for higher stakes than they're comfortable with. You know, when you're on a final table, you're playing really high stakes poker with short stacks. That's all. So, yeah, I still think the best edge is in tournaments. When I do play cash, you know, I still prefer the mixed games, but they're not nearly as popular as they used to be. And, I mean, sometimes I'll just bang out a session of a whole bunch of, like, 1-2-2-4 tables, but I certainly don't enjoy that as much as the tournaments.
How's the mixed action on the I mean, if you're playing on the U.S.-facing sites, I mean, is there mixed game stuff worth playing on there?
There used to be a really good stud 8 game on ACR for a while, but I haven't seen anything exciting going in quite some time.
Do you still, I mean, do you go to Mexico sometimes to play on, like, PokerStars or something?
I haven't been to Mexico to play poker since last November, which is kind of ironic, when I could literally walk to Mexico right. About 4 minutes. I should go over there and at least just, like, do something with the money I have in stars. But I mean, this year I've been so involved with cryptocurrency that when I'm not playing poker, I am either trading crypto, researching crypto, or breeding crypto kitties, which has been the way I've been printing Ethereum this winter. So haven't really been the need to go to Mexico for anything other than tacos and cheap groceries lately.
So I've heard the term crypto kitty, but that's about all I know about it. What is a crypto kitty?
You know, I'm one of the best in the world at it, and I still don't understand. It's a digital token that has a piece of cat art attached to it. And when you can breed these cats together, and you basically create a math problem of what their offspring is going to be, and all that is attached to an open market where people buy and sell these cats on an exchange using Ethereum. Small rake by the company that set it all up, and there's certain like fancy cats and stupid things that make them more valuable. I mean, it's the internet version of the Beanie Baby, basically. Okay. You know, it's a scarce digital collectible that has demand. A lot of it is gambly. Like, you have to pay, you know, a small fee of like $4 now to breed a pair of cats. And sometimes you make a cat that's worth a lot of money, and sometimes you make a cat that's not worth anything at all, and you lose. So, you know, it's almost like beating slot machines, where your cost goes in and you have, you know, an expected value in your output, which is variable with the market. And yeah, you just have to beat it, follow the trends, see what people are buying, why they're buying it, and then how to make those things cheaper than what they're paying for them, basically.
What does it mean to be the best at it?
You make the most money at it, just like anything else in gambling, right?
Yeah, but I guess, like, what are the skills that enable you to make more money at it than someone else?
Having money in the first place, having the awareness of risk and just all these gambling principles that go into it, understanding the markets and, big side of CryptoKitties also is just exploiting the market. A lot of times I see things on the market that are just too cheap, so I buy them and then I relist them and sell them later. It's just a total awareness of, how to make money in an environment.
So you kind of have to make choices about which kinds of cats you're going to try to breed or something?
Yeah, when you breed them together, there is a bit of an attrition on the cat. So, you can't just go in willy-nilly and click buttons. You'll definitely lose money doing that. Very strategic in my breedings, and everything else just kind of gets sold. And yeah.
How did you get into doing that?
Being deeply involved in cryptocurrency kind of made me aware of CryptoKitties that very first weekend that it became super popular, and it really clogged up the Ethereum blockchain for a week, and everyone was like, what in the world? And if something was that popular to basically completely shut down a network with so many transactions going on, and, got my attention. Harlebob made a tweet about it. It may have been pretty cheeky, but he was talking about how you can make money there. I'm like, well, Harlebob can make money doing this, and I should pay attention to this. back in the early days when money was flying around, there was really no solvers at all. So we went in and figured out the genetic code and realized that there's a lot more than meets the eye and hidden things and how they can be combined to yield outputs that no one else is really thinking about. So
there are CryptoKitties solvers now?
Yeah, now there's solvers where there's a site called Kitty Calc where you can punch in your two kitty numbers and it'll give you the exact probabilities of what your output's going to be.
And that doesn't destroy the market?
It's certainly hurt the market a little bit, but it's also opened up the market to a lot of people, being able to understand what's going on and have a lot more knowledge of why they're playing, which gives them more of an interest in playing. It's like they'll teach you how to play blackjack because they want you to play blackjack.
So, right.
Yeah, and more people in the market's a good thing. So it's pretty amazing, the scarcity that can happen with these cats. There's just basically infinite combinations, and if you put a little bit of demand on the market, it just, makes the supply disappear. So there's been a few runs in the last month or so where whales out of Asia just come in and just buy up all this stuff, and suddenly, nothing's around. And if you want it, you got to pay for it. And, so you just got to surf those waves. And it's way more fun than playing online poker. Easier to do in the slow time.
What you said about the value of other people understanding the game well enough to play it or something, I don't know if that's a fair paraphrase exactly of what you said, but it's kind of how I felt about poker training sites as well, which uh-huh. I'm a little biased because I work for some of them, or have worked for some of them, but uh-huh. Did that create, and I know you were around in that era as well when Card Runners first started doing that kind of stuff, and everyone's like, oh, this is going to be the end of poker, you're educating the fish, da 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 da. And I think it definitely has changed and made the games harder, but I think it probably does increase the longevity of the games also, because to some degree you sort of need people to I think for a fair number of people, feeling like they're making progress is important to them, mm-hmm. and feeling like they're getting better, and they're willing to pay for that. Essentially, they're willing to play in games where they're not favorites if it means that they can sort of be practicing things, but I think they want to know what to practice. Some group of people do.
Yeah, for sure. And something to give them a little hope, But I worked for Poker VT back in those days. Oh yeah, Poker VT paid me really well. They started me at $600 an hour and moved me up to $750 an hour, so I kind of didn't really care.
Right.
It's good to get people into the game and feel like they have some tools that they can use. I think it's absolutely essential, in this environment of the internet and computers and information and knowledge, people are just going to quit in a hurry if they can't figure out, or at least feel like they're getting better, So I think we learned a lot. Like, I definitely was a little bit too open with the information I passed out back then, and now I'm a little bit more reserved with it. But I mean, poker's good now. Like, it's way softer than it was in 2012. So,
why do you say that?
In 2012, there was still a whole bunch of professionals floating around, and now a lot of them are no longer around.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, and it sounds like you're doing a decent amount of this now with kind of traveling with the WSOP circuit, but that there's really two separate jobs, or at least two jobs, to being a professional poker player, skills involved, one of which is the actual card playing, like being able to play better than the people you're playing with, one of which also is just sort of making good games happen and or being invited to good games. And this is, have both of those skills or need to have both of those skills or whatever. But I think to some degree a group like WSOP Circuit or World Poker Tour or something like that, essentially what you're doing as a professional is like outsourcing that second skill where you're saying, okay, you guys put the games together, I'll just show up and play well. And you don't really have to have the same concern. Like if you're a traveling tournament pro, you don't have to have the same kind of concern. Not that you want to be outright rude to people, but the idea of like kind of cultivating a local market and like making friends with the people who are going to make a game happen and like that kind of stuff. You're sort of like outsourcing that skill and paying for it. I mean, you're paying Rake, or they're getting WPT or WSOP Circuit is getting their share of the money that losing players are willing to lose. But that's kind of how I see that happening anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think we still have a bit of a responsibility there. I know that many of the people I played with this winter, in all these random places from Tahoe to Tunica, like, they're like, whoa, Diva, what are you doing here? And, like, they enjoyed that part of, playing on this World Series circuit in this little local stop that, players that they can recognize are in the room. And they're like, whoa, I got to play with somebody I saw on TV. Like, how cool is that? And,
yeah.
Like, that helps with the local market, and that helps them to come back next time. Yeah, I mean, there's still a responsibility to cultivating the game. Like, we're so much more long-term. The poker community is, much smaller and way more connected now, so.
Yeah, I certainly agree kind of in terms of, like, a responsibility or what a player ought to do, but in terms of the incentive, like, I see the incentives of a traveling tournament player different than the incentives of a local or primarily local cash game player. And it's actually sort of frustrating sometimes from the perspective of the latter, which is primarily what I am these days, where it's sort of like you see people who are never going to play in your local casino again, or at least not until next year, sort of show up and they don't have nearly as much interest in you do as you do in maximizing the quality of the experience of someone who maybe is a regular in the game that you're playing in. And so you see them just sort of, berating them over a bad beat or just like stupid stuff that I think you see less of that from cash game players because they have more of an interest in like an immediate interest in customer satisfaction, essentially, in a way that tournament players are like, well, what do I care about this guy? I'm not going to see him. I won't be back at this casino until next year. So I don't really have the same incentive, even if they're wrong. Like the short-term incentive, at least, is just not there for them in the same way that there is.
Yeah, for sure. And I've also noticed that with some like traveling pros, like, when I was more full-time in Colorado and spending time in those games up there, which I guess since I don't live there anymore, can just come out and say they're really good. We play 30-60 with a kill to 50-100, and it often takes hours before I am free bet for my first time. It's an amazing game, and I've definitely noticed people coming from out of town and just really be rude. And like, if they stick around for more than a day or two, I kind of go out of my way and be like, hey man, like, I know who you are. I know you're really good at this game, but this is a pretty small local community group of people here. We don't know you. We all know each other. Like, can't you just be nice?
Yeah. What kind of reception do you get? Do you find that people will kind of change their ways when you say something to them?
Yeah. I'm only saying that to someone who, is going to understand and, has their own home game somewhere. And you know, it usually comes over a doobie and a friendship first. So.
How important has the friendships been to your progression, improvement as a poker player? I mean, it seems like you're a very widely known and well-liked guy, and were even more so, I guess, when you were playing more full-time.
Mm-hmm. It was absolutely essential to my start. I was pretty much on my own from 99 to 02 in my formative years. Like, I had a few, like, you know, friends along the way that I pretty quickly passed in skill level, and they were just kind of like sounding boards along the way. one of these guys came up with one of the best quotes that I still use to this day. I was talking about how I did this and I did that. There's no way this guy should have called with his hand, but he called, man. Like, I couldn't believe he called. Like, he's not beating anything. My buddy just goes, dude, these guys wouldn't notice if an elephant walked across the table, much less the subtle shit you're trying to show them. I'm like, oh, all right. But, I mean, then when I moved to Minnesota in 2005, that's when I really went ballistic. Mike Schneider, Jay Mellencone, Mike Pickett, Kirby Rogers, Brian Clark, like some absolute wizards at the limit hold'em, and very active on 2+2. So they got me on 2+2. We spent a lot of time together. Like, we had all thought of things that nobody else had thought of before, and we, together as a unit, just made each other so much better. And, you know, from there on out, it was moved to Vegas in 06 and learned really quickly that the only way to get better is to surround myself with better players. And so it's something that I'm very intentional about doing. It's a bit harder now, you know, being, you know, this remote and doing a lot of stuff solo again, but I also think I'm a little bit more careful with the secrets that I'm giving up because I'm at a pretty high level, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would like to find somebody to talk to more regularly about poker, but most of those people that I talk to regularly about poker, we just talk about crypto now instead. So,
yeah, what is researching crypto? I mean, we talked about the crypto kitty stuff, but other than that, like, what kind of research goes into?
I mean, it's everything. There's no such thing as an expert at cryptocurrency. So, like, anything that I can get my hands on, I'm learning. I've learned about technical analysis and all that sort of charting stuff, which I don't think applies to crypto at all, but I do think it applies to the metagame. I think a lot of people use technical analysis to make their decisions, and if you can predict what other people are going to be making decisions based on, then you can make your decisions considering that. It all started when I binked on ACR back in 2016, and I ended up with a pile of Bitcoin. And maybe I shouldn't liquidate all this yet. Let's start looking into that. That's, you know, back when Bitcoin was at 600 or so, and yeah, I just started learning about, like, what is Bitcoin. You know, while we're at it, what is fiat currency? I mean, that's a whole month worth of research right there.
Right.
I pretty quickly realized that, like, this is undervalued. And, I mean, really, that's the game we're playing. Like, it's all so speculative. There's still very little use cases for cryptocurrency. You know, online poker is a great use case for crypto. It's why most of us got into it, because we were using it. So now it's like, all right, well, how's the rest of the world going to use this and adopt this? And when is that going to happen? Is that going to happen? And if they do, then what is this going to be worth? And if they don't, then what is it going to be worth? And so I'm definitely, like, that's why I was pursuing the circuit instead of, like, WPTs, because I'm pretty close to all in on cryptocurrency and just trying to, you know, minimalize so that I can acquire as much Bitcoin as possible, because I think that it is going to change the world and it is still undervalued. And yeah, it's just a better form of money that can't be controlled or messed with or tinkered with, you know, by some so feel free with other puts.
Oh, sorry. Feel free not to answer, and we can even like cut this out if you don't want to. But when you say you're all in on crypto, does that mean you're fully committed to it, or like you really like it, or does that mean pretty much all of my net worth is in crypto? Which is true of some people.
I believe in it. I am fascinated by it, and I have about 80% of my net worth in crypto.
Wow.
Yeah, I think those former two things follow pretty clearly from the latter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been an exciting ride, huh?
Yeah, you're in surprisingly good spirits, considering where things stand now.
Yeah, and a lot of that really just comes from understanding. You know, like, I definitely sold some at the peak. Like, I am, like, quintuple free-rolling. I got paid from draft.com, finally got around to it from last fantasy football season, got this check, but they sent me an electronic check via email that took like 3 days to get there, and then I deposit it like 3 days ago, and I'm going to get the money in like another 3 days. It just makes no sense. There's so many better ways to do this.
I was about to ask you something and I forgot. Well, anyway, one thing I wanted to ask you, you know, what was the, when you first started playing around the LA area, like well before the poker boom took off, I mean, what was the scene like in those days?
There were no such thing as kids my age. I was playing at the Commerce Casino I started playing there when I was 19 years old. I didn't even have a fake ID. I didn't even bother. I was never asked by anybody ever how old I was. Nobody cared. And they assumed that, oh, kid, USC, must be a trust fund baby. Let him in. And, yeah, I remember my 21st birthday, like shortly thereafter, I was playing 1530 at the Commerce Casino. And I order a Corona. And she cards me. And Jack, who's still a floor man there, he goes, oh, I've known Diva for 2 years. He is good. He is good. Jack, I just got to card him. He goes, let me see this. He looks at it, and I've been 21 for like 5 days. And he just laughs and pats me on the back and walks away.
That's a good
story. I remember about a year before that, I was playing 612 down in the pit, and it was one of the super jackpot hours where it was 100K bad beat jackpot, and the qualifier was aces full of tens beat. Could have been aces full of anything, but, you know, on the turn, there's three aces on board, which didn't disqualify it. I've got ace queen, and the other guy has a neon sign around his neck that says, I have a big pair. And I'm 20 years old, about to shit my pants. And I'm like, what do I do? Well, I bet he calls. Get that $12 in there, of course. And the river is a king, which nullifies the bad beat. You know, I bet he calls. Everyone's like, oh, my God, what a bad beat. We didn't win the bad beat. And I'm thinking, like, oh, my God, what an incredible 7-outer that I just hit. Like, it finally took me until, like, a few years ago to figure out what I should have done in that instance. But I was so lucky to not hit a bad beat. I might have gotten shanked out in that Commerce parking lot before I even made it to 21.
Yeah, it took me a second to realize what you meant by that. And I was like, oh, I see what the complication would have been there.
Yeah.
How well did you get on? I mean, I'm assuming you're playing with other people then who are much older than you were. How well did you, like, fit into that community of people who were playing there at that time?
I didn't. I was definitely an outsider of the community. I was this, you know, college kid that would surf and then go to the casino and not care about college. And So, I mean, I was always, like, pretty bubbly personality and, you know, never mean to people because even if I'm selfish, I'm still going to advance my cause more by being nice to people. So, yeah, I mean, I just peacefully grinded and went to the commerce. And, back then, I would spend my summers at a camp up in the mountains outside of California. So I was, you know, always kind of being outside and wanted to work with people and wanted to be outside with people. So, I mean, it all kind of flows naturally together, like coming from Magic the Gathering, being a game of probabilities against people, you know, go to the woods, take people outside, you know, really flows well into poker because, you know, poker is a technical game, but it's a game of people.
That's interesting. You know, you don't hear a lot of people, like, I feel like in the current era, the game of people part gets downplayed a lot. And I suppose that's from so many people still having had a background in online poker, like starting an online poker or something, maybe just people that I'm in a circle with. But for all the people that we've interviewed, it's, you're sort of in a minority to put that so front and center, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, even when you're playing online, there's still a human being on the other side clicking them buttons.
Yeah. Where did you kind of, I mean, were you raised by people who enjoyed doing stuff outdoors? Or what was the early impetus of your desire or need or whatever to do outdoorsy kind of stuff?
It's always just been where I was happiest. My dad raced motorcycles professionally from the late 60s until 1984. I was born in 81, so I kind of grew up in the desert, you know, with a bike between my legs. And that was, like, the thing I did with my dad a lot. We would go out to the desert and just be outside. And, my best friend, growing up, little mountain kid, we would hike up into the woods all the time. And I grew up in San Dimas, California, which is right on the foothills outside of LA. I would spend my summers doing stuff like my dad would drop me off at the lake on his way to work, and then I would fish with my brother all day until Raging Waters opened, and then we'd go into Raging Waters and look at all the junior highers in bikinis because we were in junior high and thought this was pretty. And we would take snorkels into the lazy river and face masks, and we'd pick up all this money, and that's how we'd finance our operation. And it's just being outside. And then surfing. I mean, I would get to the beach, and I've always loved water. I've always loved sun. So, you know, when I discovered whitewater rafting, my first trip was in 01, I'm like, wow, this is really fun, but it's also really expensive, and I don't have much money, and so how can I do this all the time? They're like, well, you get a job doing it. And it's like, I'll try that.
It's kind of surprising given how much, I mean, just to hear, I can hear it in your voice when you talk about being outdoors, that you're able to tolerate spending some, or that you are able to tolerate spending so much time in casinos. Like, I mean, I know some other people who are, I'm acquainted with people who are, you know, professional, like, mountain bike guides, for instance. And, I mean, similar to a lot of things you describe, where, like, they really like mountain biking, and that's a question of how do I finance it? Okay, I do it, I'll be a professional mountain bike guide. But I think those people would go crazy sitting inside of a casino for hours on end.
Well, marijuana is a hell of a drug, and when I'm in casinos, I understand that I am basically acquiring fun coupons so that I can be in this place and be able to, you know, live on a raft guide salary, but also not have to worry about, like, the little details, like, you know, it's just, I'm comfortable. Like, I don't need any more money. Like, I don't need any things. What I do need is to be outside and to be on the river. And, like, that is absolutely essential to my soul. Whereas money is just, it's a tool, like a brush to an artist that is just useful for painting this picture of life.
I imagine that makes it easier to be, as you said, all in on the crypto as well, if you sort of feel like you're not, I imagine, kind of absolutely dependent on the money that you have in it. I mean, obviously you don't want to lose it or whatever, but I guess, like, living the lifestyle that you do makes it a little easier to take risks like that, I guess.
Yeah, It's really weird, especially like the last 2 months. Like, I feel like every time I go on an overnight raft trip, I come back out and somebody broke Bitcoin, and my colleagues are like, "How's Bitcoin doing?" It's like, "Oh, I lost 15 grand during that trip," and they just look at me like, "What?" But you know, it all came from nothing, and it all is nothing, and it is what it is today, and it will be what will be tomorrow, and our job is to figure that out the best. So it's just all about being happy. You know, you can't buy happiness with Bitcoin or anything, and whatever makes people happy is different. And I think that's the hardest challenge of life, is finding that thing that makes you happy, that gives you a reason to play poker. And, you know, in that sense, I'm very lucky and blessed to have found it so unequivocally, to just know that this is who I am and what I do and what makes me happy, and to experience that, like, you know, basically on a daily basis out here is just so cool.
Do you feel at all disconnected from the other people? Like, when you're guiding, are you generally on a team? Like, you have coworkers, I guess? I imagine they're in kind of a different situation from you financially, or like living a little bit more paycheck, from what I know of those sorts of people. You know, like having the kind of income stream that you do from poker and from crypto stuff, do you feel like that kind of sets you apart from them?
Not any more than like my experience already kind of sets me apart. Like, up in Colorado, I'm the head boatman. I am the lead instructor. Like, I'm the guy. Down here, like, I'm surrounded by wizards. This is Interlingua. It's the only place where you can go down the river all year long in the United States. And so the people that come here are basically those who have made a career out of being raft guides, and most of them have like found their form of balance to figure out how to do this as a full-time thing, and most of them are better at boating than me, and we're all just mutually fascinated with each other. Might as well pitch where I'm working right now. I work for Far Flung Outdoor Center out of Terlingua, Texas. We're the largest outfitter in the Big Bend area. Big Bend National Park is one of the largest national parks in the whole country. It's a very amazing place with incredibly spectacular canyons and just desert that is very remote but also very easily accessible at the same time. It's 90 degrees right now. I'm at a golf resort. The grass is green. The flowers are blooming. The river's right there. Santa Elena Canyon's right behind me. There's no state income tax here. Everything's cheap. People are like, it's an incredible community that is tight, built on tourism. It's just fantastic. It's very, very far away from anything. We're like 10 hours from Houston, 10 hours from Dallas, 5 hours from El Paso, 5 hours from San Antonio.
Yeah, my girlfriend and I, she a little bit more than me, but I mean, she is very into doing the outdoors kind of stuff, and we've been trying to hit all of the national parks, and Big Bend, just because it's as remote as you say, is one that have not gotten to yet. I think it's already been pretty high on the priority list, but hearing you talk about it and seeing the pictures that you've posted on, she's excited that I'm interviewing you right now. She follows you on Twitter as well.
Awesome.
But yeah, you've certainly brought that up higher on my list, or on our
cool.
list.
Cool. I'll be here for another 3 weeks or so, then I head to Colorado, but I'm absolutely planning on coming back here in the fall. In the fall, it's when the river runs higher due to hurricane season and monsoon season. That's when we have the rafts out. You can cover way more mileage on the river. Y'all should definitely come out this fall. Book a trip.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I can probably hook you up with some sort of friend discount. And, but either way, I can definitely get you out on the river.
How much, have you found yourself in a position of, like, evangelizing outdoors stuff to other poker players?
I think that I have a little bit to do of you know, the movement of poker players getting outside in the last 12 years. I mean, back in 06, when I came on the scene, like, nobody went outside and did anything. Like, right. We were just a few years removed from smoking cigarettes in poker rooms. So it was hard for me, actually, to find poker players to get outside and do things with. And, you know, I had a boat and take it out on Lake Mead and invited people all the time. And people said no all the time. And, you know, but then they started coming out, and they're like, whoa, okay, this is cool. And, you know, it's all about finding your own balance. Like, not everyone's going to be happy living in the desert like a dirtbag like I am. But, you know, there is something for every single person alive that makes you really happy. And that's what your whole life should be built around pursuing, you know. And poker gives us such a cool opportunity to be able to print our fun coupons when we want, basically, to enable us to do whatever that thing is that makes us truly happy.
Is there anything about your RV dirtbagging lifestyle that you don't? I mean, you sound overall very, very pleased with it. I know you said you wish you had thought of doing it sooner. Is there anything that is kind of unpleasant about it?
It's hard with the love life. I'm definitely lonely. I think that'll come with time. I mean, there's definitely girls like me out there, but they're few and far between and often come with very hairy legs.
Yeah, I mean, I guess living out in the dirtbagging environment is not the most conducive to personal upkeep of a variety of sorts.
Yeah, I got a gal in Dallas that I'm, you know, very close with, and we spent time together before I came out here, and it's just like, she's like, well, I don't camp, so now what? I'm like, well, I ain't living in a city, so, you know, see you next time. And that's okay, because, you know, she wouldn't be happy camping, and I wouldn't be happy in a city, so this is what it is.
What kind of provisions have you had to make living in the RV? I guess, like, what's been challenging for you living out of the RV?
I mean, besides the loneliness part, like, nothing. Like, I can't believe it took me this long to do it. It just fits so well with my lifestyle. It's so much cheaper. I mean, I paid $4,700 for this camper. And, like, my costs are, you know, tank of propane every few weeks. Like, got a solar panel that runs all my electricity. Like I am so dang minimalist right now, and I still feel like there's too much crap in my life. Like, clutter and stuff. And so, it's, like, the challenges become fun. Like, you get presented with these new sets of just things that you have to do that you've never thought of until you try living in an RV, and it's like, well, I've got to do this, and this today, you know, which kind of makes up for the time that you're saving not dealing with a house and stuff, but it's like fun. Yeah, I mean, learning a lot, like, definitely beating up my camper and could have done things better, but again, because I've paid for my camper twice by not paying rent this winter.
Like, right.
That's cool. I could just throw the thing away and be up on the winter by not paying $1,500 a month in rent again.
What are you doing for internet? Are you just strictly going places that have internet, or do you do, like, satellite?
I haven't figured out a good solution for satellite internet yet. There's a few options. None of them are good enough or worth the cost that I've found yet. So yeah, I just kind of go places with internet. Like, we have internet at most of the boathouses, or all the boathouses I work at, and they're very good at, you know, having, like, a guide area so the guides can be basically, you know, have a place to call home because they don't get paid much. Like, they understand what's going on here, and guides are obviously a necessary part of the river operation. And if you pay guides less, then you can make the trips less, and then we work out tips kind of thing, and then they just support us. Like, well, what do you need? You need a kitchen, you need a place to sleep, you need some internet. Cool, no problem. We'll set that up for you. We got showers and bathrooms over there. Welcome. And, you know, there's plenty of places to poach internet around, like I am now over here at the Lajitas Golf Resort on our way up to a river trip. So it's not hard. I mean, it's just a matter of time until there's just kind of internet everywhere, right?
So, I mean, you feel like you have a pretty good... I mean, I guess one way of interpreting that could be that it's sort of an exploitative relationship, right? That they're, like, making a lot of money on the tours and paying you very little or something like that. But it doesn't sound like that's really the way that you're experiencing it or the way it seems to be.
Oh, no. It's totally a symbiotic relationship. I thought very hard about buying a rafting company in 2014. And yeah, I looked at a couple. I came close to buying one, and then I just kind of realized, like, man, this is so much work, and all these guys, these owners, like, they don't get on the river anymore. They're not as happy as they used to be. You know, they all seem to be pretty burnt out after like 15, 20 years of owning these rafting companies. So I understand their role, and I support it and accept it, and have very consciously chosen to not go down that road because I just don't want to deal with a headache, and I would rather, you know, spend my time making money on the internet, which I'm always finding a way to do. Back then in 2014, it was a lot of DraftKings FanDuel sort of thing. You know, and then online poker was coming back then too, so yeah. Never saw CryptoKitties in my future, but,
but here we are.
There's always going to be something. There's always going to be something. So,
so you really feel like it's more the owners who are getting the raw deal. Like you're actually on the better end of the transaction.
Yeah. But I mean, that's also because, like, you know, I can make money on the internet. Mm-hmm. Getting back to, like, you know, my dirtbag colleagues, they're all very aware of, like, you need something else to really make this sustainable. And so, like, some of the kids, like, they were learning from me this year. We all put a bunch of Raft Guide money on Florida State in the first game in March Madness. And I'm encouraging my friend Neil, who I'm going on this trip with this afternoon, to start a podcast about rafting because there isn't one. And he knows everybody and travels around and would just have an infinite source of, you know, guests to have on this podcast. Like, this one guy that we're working with right now, his name is Dan Kay. He's 68 years old. He's been a raft guy for about 60 of those years, for 50 of those years. Like, this guy has just done everything, seen everything, and he's just lived out of his truck basically the whole time. And he's an absolutely fascinating individual, and he doesn't need anything else. He's just like, you know, I ain't going to go get that Coke for $3. I don't want it bad enough.
Yeah, I don't know much about rafting, but I think I would listen to that. Sounds like an interesting guy.
Oh, yeah. And there's a market there. Like, I think it would be great.
And there are, I guess, companies that would sponsor ads or something like that. I mean, is that?
Oh yeah, the outdoor industry in general, it is a bigger industry than oil and gas. It employs more people, it pays more taxes, and it makes more revenue. It is a larger source of the GDP than oil and gas. Way bigger than coal. Way bigger than so many of these things. And like, we really need to be having our own lobby, but we're all way too lazy and dirtbag to really get out there and be like, hey, look, like, if it's all about money, like, then you need to treat the environment with respect, because we're actually making more money than the people that you're giving this land to drill wells in. Like, so, I mean, yeah, I guess that's the advocacy side of things that I do. Like, the more I get out here and the more I reach out to the internet, the more I realize I have this opportunity to like teach people about things that they've never even thought of before. Like, hey, maybe I shouldn't flush my pee every single time because this water comes from that river over there and I've never connected that, but now that I've floated down this river and see how low it is compared to what it used to be, I'm going to think about that.
Yeah, I do think that's kind of a big misunderstanding. I think there's a popular conception of sort of conservationists or something, that they're just people, like, some people enjoy the outdoors and some people don't. And if you're an advocate for the outdoors, it's just because you're just sort of advocating your personal interest. And like, I like these places to be pretty because I like to go there. And so people who don't like to go there are like, well, what do I care? I don't go there. And I think like the point, the way you're articulating it, which makes more sense, is more just that it is actually a value whether you're going there or not, but going there helps you to see that. It's not a matter of just, you know, sort of a selfishly advocating for, like, this is the recreation that I enjoy, and so I want to keep it available for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but it's so cool that we have, like, real meat of facts, you know, beyond that. Yeah, this is fun. We should protect the rivers. Like, no, check all this stuff out. Like, it's so connected, man.
Any tidbits of wisdom like that that you want to leave people with?
Well, I mean, understand that water comes from somewhere, and water is going to be a very precious commodity in the next 50 years. Water rights are based on things that we drew up in the late 1800s, early 1900s. That period of history was exceptionally wet, not just average, not just more than now. It was exceptionally wet. Water rights are extremely overallocated. They absolutely need to be completely rewritten from scratch. It's going to be a very big deal thing in the future. I mean, Las Vegas is not sustainable. They are on their third straw into Lake Mead because the level has dropped so much that the first two straws are no longer in the water. They have built a tunnel that cost billions of dollars out underneath the lake, and they came up underneath and are draining Lake Mead now like a bathtub. People died in that project. Can you imagine being the guy that had to, like, tink, 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 tink through the bottom of the lake? Yeah, I mean, just awareness is the first step. Just being aware that this water comes from somewhere and it is not infinite. And, I mean, if we all turn off the water when we're brushing our teeth, like, we're talking millions of gallons being saved just by that one simple act.
And for people flying into Las Vegas, you know, you can see this pretty clearly when you fly over. Like, I mean, you can see where the water lines used to be and where they are now. And that's not a coincidence. It's not just like, oh, we've had a drought or something like that. Like, it's a result of the water being, you know, drawn down in the ways that you're describing.
Yeah, it is over diverted. There are, I mean, many hundreds of straws into the Colorado River drainage. Right now, through the Grand Canyon into Lake Mead, the Colorado River is flowing at about 13,000 cubic feet of water per second. A cubic foot of water is about the size of a basketball. So imagine 13,000 basketballs full of water rumbling into Lake Mead per second. It's a ton of water, right? By the time we get past Hoover Dam, Davis Dam, Havasu Dam, there's a whole bunch more down there. The last one is called Imperial Dam. At that point, part of the river goes to the right, off to San Diego. Part of the river goes off to the left, up to Tucson. And the rest of it trickles out the bottom into Yuma, Arizona. And coming out of Imperial Dam is 330 cubic feet of water per second. It's an incredible, like, change to the environment, to water that should be going to the Sea of Cortez. The delta of the Colorado River used to be the greatest wetland on the face of the planet with all sorts of wildlife down there, and now it is just straight up gone. All the delta needs to replenish itself is 5% of the native flow. We won't even let it have that. Rio Grande over here is the same thing. By the time it hits El Paso, over 95% of the water has been diverted. The Rio Grande River that I'm working on, all of the water comes out of Mexico, and they don't even raise a stink about it. It's pretty amazing what we're doing with water, and yeah, I hope we can do something about it before it's too late.
Any books or documentaries or anything you'd recommend for people interested in this?
Yeah, Cadillac Desert is a really good one. And documentary, there's one called Damnation that you can find on Netflix. That's a really good one also. If you want to get specifically into the Colorado River, there's a really cool series called Down the Colorado, where these two fellows took boats from the headwaters of the Colorado River all the way down to the Sea of Cortez and just kind of talk about this along the way. That one's on Vimeo.
Nice. Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much for taking the time, and hope you have a great trip coming up and enjoy. I guess that you're just now getting into the best part of your season.
Yeah, it's going to be weird going from 90 degrees here to 50 degrees again in Colorado in May. But, you know, guide school starts on May 14th, and yeah, that'll be exciting. This is my first year being the lead instructor of guide school. I've been an instructor for many years, but never the guy.
Nice. Well, congratulations on that, and have fun.
Thanks. I will. Really appreciate you guys having me on, and hope I can do it again sometime.
I was blessed.
Take care. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Devotion of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.